I'm the producer and host of the Republican Professor podcast, Lucas J. Mather, welcoming you to the Republican Professor on February 5th, 2025, years after. Well, that would be after Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, Anno Domini, 2025, in the year of our Lord. And we're picking up in the Snitko case on the Fourth Amendment. Now, I think that it's a good idea to get the Fourth Amendment in our mind here. What do you say we take a look at it? U.S. Constitution, Amendment 4, the right of the people to be secure. The right of the what? The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. The subject of those verbs are not mentioned, but they're implied. Who's doing the searching? Who's doing the seizing? That would be the government, my friends, the government. Against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, particularly describing the place to be searched by who? The government, and the person or things to be seized. Where else do we see this phrase, the right of the people? Well, I don't know about you, but I see it in the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people. There it is. It's also in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech. The freedom of speech of who? Who has the freedom of speech? The government? Or of the press? Or the right of the people peaceably to assemble? No split infinitive there. And to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Well, that's interesting. It's almost as if this amendment assumes that the people and the government are not the same thing, and the people have rights that are spelled out against the government. That's exactly the theory of the Bill of Rights that makes the most sense. Take a look at the Third Amendment. No soldier, well, that sounds like the government to me, shall, in times of peace, be quartered. Quartered by who? Who does the quartering? It's the government. In any house, okay, who owns the house? Without the consent of the owner. Well, who's the owner? Sounds like the people. Nor in time of war, but in manner to be prescribed by law. That's a right of the people right there. The Fourth Amendment carries on that tradition. The Fifth Amendment. No person. This is a right of the people. Against what? Against the state. Against the government. Now, I'm centering your mind on this, okay? Because This is very important in understanding the Snitgo case. And we haven't been on the Snitgo case since 17 January. I gave you a break and we went to Chevron. And we're still in Chevron. But we're going to continue through our tour of the swirly twirly gumdrops of the Snitgo case before we get to the Lincoln Tunnel. And here we are on page 1263. How do I know it's 1263? Well, I printed this out from Google Scholar and I also checked in the law library and it's generally the same page number. I didn't check this particular case. This is brand new, 2024. The volumes are not out yet in the law library. The local law libraries around here, like Chapman and Pepperdine, are behind. Pepperdine especially is behind in the volume accumulation. One moment here. No, actually, okay. I'm going to go ahead and show you how to get to the Snitko case. We're going to go to Google Scholar. And the way you get to Google Scholar is you search Bing and then you type in DuckDuckGo. You search that. And when you get to DuckDuckGo, ha 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 ha. So what I do is I went to Google Scholar, I went to Federal Cases, and then I went to Snitko versus United States 2024 Ninth Circuit. We're going to clicky little wiki. It's 2024. This is it. And we're on Firefox, so they're not bringing the page numbers on the side like I like. Chrome does that. I'm pretty sure Chrome does that. But we're in Roman numeral two, right? Well, we're on 1263, and there is a Roman numeral two there on 1263. So, let me just go down to 1263, scrolling down. There's 1260. See that? It's embedded in the text here. There's Roman numeral one. We've covered that. And we should be coming up on Roman numeral two right here. So here's 1263. This is the last part we covered right here. So I would suggest you go back to the prior episode to catch up. And review, just you all you have to do is review the last part of that if you want a refresher on where we're at. If I spent so much time reviewing, we would never get ahead. All right, here we go. The district court abused its discretion in holding that the government did not exceed the scope of the warrant. The district court's incorrect assumption that the ordinary rules of the inventory search doctrine apply to this case also infected its analysis of other Fourth Amendment issues, such as plaintiff's claim that the government exceeded the scope of the warrant. Specifically, the district court, and remember the district court guy was a Republican, so this is Republicans on the Ninth Circuit reversing a Republican mistake. Remember that. The district court concluded that whether the government exceeded the warrant's scope hinged on whether the search it conducted fit within the inventory search exception, without considering how these two inquiries might not be one and the same. They are not the same. There you go. Overturning the district court right there. They're not the same. As the district court recognized, did you notice I skipped over some quotation of a prior case. So I'm not going to always be, especially if they're in parentheses. Those, in my opinion, should be in footnotes because they're in parentheses. As the district court recognized, the inventory search doctrine as developed in our circuit, that's the Ninth Circuit, tolerates the presence of a criminal investigatory motive when conducting an inventory, or a dual motive, one valid and one impermissible. The standard for determining the permissibility of an inventory search is whether the search would have occurred but for the government's alleged improper investigatory purpose. By contrast, to determine whether the government exceeded the scope of a warrant, we compare the terms of the warrant to the search actually conducted. What's he saying there? What's dual motive mean? We covered this last time. This might be something I'll spend a moment to review. You have the Fourth Amendment. Let's review the Fourth Amendment right now. It's a right of the people to not be subjected to unreasonable searches. And the reasonability is partially spelled out here, but it's not entirely spelled out. The substance of reasonability is gives a defendant something to latch on to claim that a particular search would be, in fact, unreasonable, substantively unreasonable. How might that go? And how might the government defend itself? Well, maybe the warrant did not issue upon probable cause. Maybe it wasn't supported by oath or affirmation, or the oath or affirmation was had a problem, had a significant problem. Maybe the particular describing of the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, maybe those were ignored in the warrant. That would be unreasonable search. Now, there is an exception. There are exceptions in our case law. These are exceptions that are created in many cases by courts to the warrant requirement. And so, for example, there's an automobile exception, and you can get specific into that, especially if you're in traffic law. If you do traffic stuff, police officers really should be on top of all this because it's really their job to make sure they're paying attention to the warrant requirements. A lot of these cases come about because police have done certain things and th those things are challenged in court, and new situations bring out different judgments, and th whichever judgment wins the highest level, it becomes an exception. I mean, if it is an exception, and there are exceptions in these case laws, these cases that have gone before the court. So one such exception here is administrative law. Okay. Now, recall the facts of this case are that the FBI swarmed in and took 700 safety deposit boxes, took over the entire premises. These safety deposit boxes, The ownership of them was not perspicuous from the outside. It wasn't obvious. The whole point of having the safety deposit box in the manner that it was rented out, which is perfectly legal, was to maintain privacy. So why would you broadcast whose a box this is to the public or to any public-facing, publicly accessible area? That would defeat the whole purpose of the whole product, and the product, the renting of these secure lock boxes was perfectly legal and moral, perfectly moral. Now, do criminals take advantage of products like this that are perfectly legal and moral? Well, of course. Criminals use automobiles. But would you say that having an automobile is impermissible? You want to shut down all the dealerships? Criminals take advantage of all sorts of things. I'm sure that they use soap in the shower. I mean, maybe at least some of them do. They probably go through the drive-through and get food. So it's not the case that everything that is touched or used by a criminal is therefore illegal and immoral. That's just not the case. That would be a reductio ad absurdum of that theory. So innocent people could and were caught up in this thing, and their property is now in the custody of the FBI. Is the FBI originally had people in their purview that they had probable cause that were criminals, that were breaking federal law of one kind or another. And so those were the targets of the investigation. They didn't have enough information to distinguish which of the lock boxes were the criminals they were looking at and which were the non-criminals that they had no probable cause to go after. So you have these innocent people, and the probable cause and the warrant does not apply to them in a criminal investigation. But there's an exception. It's called an inventory exception. It's a part of administrative law, it's not part of the criminal law. The administrative law allows the government to do an inventory of what they have in their possession from a crime scene to determine what they have and try to turn the ownership of what they have. Now, the tricky thing is of course, this is what they want to do. Do they have a dual motive? Do they have a criminal investigatory motive? Yes, they do. They do have such a motive. They have, as the Ninth Circuit has recognized, the presence of a criminal investigatory motive in doing the inventory administrative law search of these innocent people's boxes, these innocent people who have a right to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Right? You guys following this? They have a valid motive as well. Who? The FBI has a valid motive. The valid motive is that the admin law allows an inventory search to determine you don't have explosives, you don't have, well, you have to kind of log who owns what box. There's a search that's done not for criminal investigative purposes, but just to determine for the purpose of having accountability of what they have in their possession and whether it's safe to have that in their warehouse or wherever. It's not going to catch fire. It's not going to, cause biological outbreak of anthrax or whatever like that. Not the band, but the disease. Okay. And what the Ninth Circuit is saying here is that the case law before, the precedent as developed in our circuit, doesn't care whether there's a criminal investigatory motive, as long as that's not the only one. This would be an invalid motive. The valid one would be the inventory search. So merely to dis for the plaintiff to say, merely to say they're criminally investigating my box would not have them win under the precedent. Now, right here, this panel says, by contrast, to determine whether the government exceeded the scope of the warrant, we compare the terms of the warrant to the search. So, in other words, this court is saying, we're taking this warrant very seriously. We're going to read it very carefully. What did the warrant say? What did it say exactly? And did they abide by those terms? Because if they didn't, they exceeded the scope of the warrant, and then that would be an unreasonable search and seizure, and the plaintiff wins. Okay. Following this, how fun is this? Scale of 1 to 10, 11, at least an 11. All right. Well, here we go. Let's continue. The warrant in this case did not authorize a criminal search or seizure of contents of safety deposit boxes. The district court never analyzed what this prohibition in the warrant meant. This is fascinating. This is what I love about this opinion in the Ninth Circuit. Again, this is Snitgo versus US. Oh, this is just so great. The 90th volume of the fourth series in the Federal Reporter, page 1250 and following. So awesome. This is a very perceptive panel. They're paying close attention. They're taking their job seriously. I love it. Praise God. Thank God for judges like this. This is the kind you want the Senate to confirm. Oh, man. We need to have good senators that pay attention to this stuff and good judges. This is so great. The warrant in this case did not authorize a criminal search or seizure of contents of the safety deposit boxes. The district court never analyzed what this prohibition in the warrant meant. That means that the lower court that found for the FBI, they ignored that and they made a mistake. But it did, by all accounts, find that the search of the USPV constitute a criminal search or seizure of box contents. That is an examination of a person's property for purposes of finding evidence of a crime. For example, the district court noted that given the record evidence, there can be no question that the government expected or even hoped to find criminal evidence during its inventory. The district court cited testimony by investigating agents who candidly admitted that they fully expected there to be criminal customers at this business, and they anticipated that there would be criminal proceeds in the safety deposit boxes. It also found that the supplemental instructions drafted by Agent Zellhart gave guidance on how to handle items with indicia of criminality, along with instructing agents on how to properly inventory the seized property. And it noted that the agents executing the warrant also arranged for drug sniffing dogs to be present at USPV, a tactic that would be unnecessary unless agents expected to discover drugs or drug adjacent cash. See, this is what the FBI wants. They want that cash. They want it for themselves, as you'll see, as you already have seen if you're paying attention. A look at the record and the supplemental instructions in particular confirms that the search, let's switch to this side, that the search, was criminal in nature. The instructions required agents not only to write a summary of the items found in safe deposit boxes, but in a section discussing preservation of evidence, told them to tag items with forfeiture numbers and send them to evidence control and take care to preserve drug evidence for fingerprints. All right, I'm skipping a little bit, just the parts that are in parentheses. Moreover, the government has confirmed that the records of box contents can be used to investigate crimes and that they have been stored on a criminal database called Sentinel and are to be kept there indefinitely. Criminal. Doesn't sound administrative to me. That's not an administ. Remember, the valid motive is the administrative admin law inventory. Well, the invalid motive is the criminal investigation search. Remember? The dual motive is okay. It's okay to have both. One valid and one impermissible. Which one is impermissible? The criminal investigative motive. That's impermissible if you want an exception to the warrant. The valid one would just be having an inventory search. But how do you tell if there really are two motives instead of just one? The criminal investigative service. Well, there would have to be indicia of just having an administrative control over the contents instead of. Everything is logged as if it's evidence in a crime. That indicates that there's one motive, not two. There's just the improper motive. Are you seeing where this is going? And you have to be perceptive here to see this. If there remained any doubt regarding whether the government conducted a criminal search or seizure, that doubt is put to rest by the fact that the government has already used some of the information from inside the boxes to obtain additional warrants to further its investigation and begin new ones. Right? And of course, precedent is being cited here because the district court's own findings show that the government did not exceed the scope of the warrant's terms. Oh, sorry. Hold up. Hold up. Because the district's own findings show that the FBI conducted a criminal search and seizure of box contents, it abused its discretion in holding that the government did not exceed the scope of the warrant's terms. This language of abuse of discretion is indicative of it being overturned. When the lower court abuses its significant discretion, it can be overturned. And in fact, it should be overturned. In addition, the district court abused its discretion in holding that the government did not exceed the bounds of the warrant in this case because it clearly erred in finding that the government was incapable of following its own standardized instructions. Recall that the warrant in this case required agents to follow their, quote, written policies, unquote. Incidentally, the FBI's written policies did indicate what an agent should do in the event he or she, one, comes across evidence of criminality during inventory search, or two, expects an inventory search to yield contraband. Specifically, the inventory policy in the DIOG states that whenever there is probable cause to believe an inventory search would also yield items of evidence or contraband. I'm on page 1265 now. Agents must obtain a search warrant when feasible. As discussed above, the district court found that the government fully expected there to be evidence of criminal proceedings and that during the course of the search, agents did find contraband, which they seized, tagged, inspected, and secured without obtaining a warrant. That shows that the FBI exceeded the scope of the warrant by failing to follow their written policies. The district court acknowledged this fact in a footnote. It stated, the FBI's standardized policies tells agents that where feasible, they should obtain a warrant for a property that may be subject to an inventory search. Here, the anonymous nature of the boxes prevented the government from determining who owned a specific box or what was inside, and thus prevented them from describing with particularity both the place to be searched and the things to be seized. Now, at this point, you should know what this is quoting right here. You should know this. It's quoting the Fourth Amendment. The place to be searched, particularly describing the place to be searched, the persons to be seized. Well, this is a right of the people to be secure. What does it mean to be secure? Here, the anonymous nature of the boxes prevented the government from determining who owned a specific box or what was inside, and thus prevented them from describing. In other words, it prevented them from following the Fourth Amendment. The district court's finding that the anonymous nature of the boxes prevented the government from determining who owned a specific box or what was inside was clearly erroneous. First, unlike the other portions of the order, which involve factual findings, this statement lacks any citation to the record. Its conclusory nature is concerning. Yeah, I would agree on that one. Especially in light of the fact that the anonymous nature of the boxes apparently did not prevent the government from obtaining and executing a search and seizure warrants of safe deposit box in the past and contacting the owner of the boxes when it issued its administrative forfeiture notices. And three, applying for and receiving additional search and seizure warrants based off of, okay, I gotta correct the judge here. It's not based off, it's based on. It's never based off, it's based on. Yeah? Tacky. Based on the contents of the items found in the safe deposit boxes after the entire USPV raid was complete. Moreover, this statement is inconsistent with the government's representation in its affidavit that it would notify box owners directly by looking for contact information or something which identifies the owner. USPV recommends that box renters include their or their designees' telephone numbers on a note in the box in the event that the USPV removes the contents for non-payment of rental fees. The conclusion that the government would not be able to obtain warrants for individual boxes appears appears to merely be an adoption. I don't like that split infinitive. Appears merely to be an adoption of a representation made by the government in its response brief below, which it itself did not cite to anything in the record. Because the district court's conclusion that the government was excused from following its standardized policy rested on its clearly erroneous finding that the government simply could not apply for warrants as to individual box holders, it abused its discretion in concluding that the government did not exceed the scope of the warrant for this reason as well. Conclusion. For the foregoing reasons, we reverse the district court's order, which held that the plaintiff's Fourth Amendment rights were not violated in light of the government's expressed willingness in its motion to vacate and remand with instructions to grant plaintiff's requested relief. To have the district court order the FBI to sequester or destroy the records of its inventory search pertaining to class members, we remand for the district court to order the FBI to so dispose of the records, including copies of the records kept on the Sentinel database. As such, the government's motion is denied as moot. Reversed and remanded. Now we have a substantive concurrence here that is at least a couple of pages long. And it's been a while since I've read this. And then there's another concurrence that's just one sentence long. But looks like Smith is concurring to it to his own opinion. And I think we should do that another time. I don't think we should spend time on this concurrence. I'm not sure if I will go through the concurrence. I would just suggest that you read it. But concurrences can be very important. Sometimes they bring up precedent that was not, the person thought was not adequately acknowledged. And so it's not always helpful to go through the concurrence. But the FBI lost. I really like this exercise for a number of reasons. One, I want to illustrate that with the proper tenacity and studiousness, you too can follow what the government is doing here. In this case, we're following the judicial branch, keeping track of the executive branch. And you can learn a lot about what's involved in that process, what kind of virtues are necessary to securing our freedoms. And you want to pay attention to that when you vote, when you raise your kids. The second thing is, I think it's a good exercise to just be aware of the kind of information that is out there And I know that some people don't like the attention to detail, but it is out there for public consumption. Why is this available publicly? It's available because the assumption is that it's for you, it's for the public. And if you just write it off, then it's almost as if we shouldn't even bother having it. If you never, ever look at any of these materials ever in your whole life, and you think that that's supposed to be normal for the electorate in America, I'm sorry, but you have it wrong. You might say, well, I rely on the media to tell me. Well, how do you know the media is giving you a fair portrait of what's happening? Well, I rely on the lawyers to tell me. Well, there's lawyers on both sides of this controversy, and one side lost, one side was wrong. And to add another layer of complexity, which you already know, sometimes the wrong side wins. And so it's not just a matter of just going about what the court decided, and oh yeah, that won, and so it's right. Sometimes the wrong side loses, and sometimes the wrong side wins. In this case, the wrong side won at the district court, and they won at the Ninth Circuit. Thank God, praise God. And I also want you to pay attention to the correlation of the proper side winning and the proper side losing. It's Republicans that are giving the right result. Sometimes they give the wrong result. And some cases, like we're going through in the Chevron case granted a win to the Republicans in 1984. Well, some of the family members of the people that won, Ann Gorsuch won, it was her agency that won. It wasn't just Chevron. EPA was on Chevron's side, and the Reagan administration won. Ann Gorsuch was the mother of Neil Gorsuch. He's on the Supreme Court now, and he's voting against what made his mother win. And it's because Republicans have had a long time, decades, to reflect on the fact that this win, we thought it was a slam dunk at the time, and turns out on reflection, maybe it was a mistake, and we got to reverse that. We got to correct the mistakes that we've made in the past. And I like that about the Republican Party. I like the fact that we're open to correcting mistakes. That's just part of being an adult. Thank you so much for being with me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've enjoyed this time. It's Wednesday, 5 February, 2025, years after Jesus.